What the hell is going on right now? And why is it happening like this? At Wired, we're obsessed with getting to the bottom of those questions, and maybe you are too. I'm Katie Drummond, the Global Editorial Director of Wired, and I'm hosting our new podcast series, The Big Interview. Each week, I'll sit down with some of the most interesting, provocative, and influential people who are shaping our right now. Listen to The Big Interview right now in the same place you find Wired's Uncanny Valley podcast.
After all the speculation about this year's Nobel Peace Prize, Venezuela's opposition leader in exile gets the call.
I have no words. This is a movement. This is an achievement of a whole society. I am just one person.
I'm Carolyn Beeler. Today, the view from Venezuela. Also, as Israel and Gaza take steps toward peace, questions loom about disarming Hamas.
We've been 80 years at this conflict now. All we've seen is a cycle of violence. It just has to break.
Plus, in the Pacific, an old rivalry has not died out.
What people will say publicly is that the temperature has been lowered, but the actions of Australia say otherwise.
Those stories ahead on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thank you for joining us today. After 2 years of death and destruction in Gaza, we're seeing what could be the beginning of the end of that war. The Israel Defense Forces posted videos of trucks and armored vehicles moving back from their positions inside of the Gaza Strip. This came after the Israeli cabinet's approval late last night of the 20-point peace plan brokered by the Trump administration. And today, around noon, the ceasefire officially went into effect. These are moments of high anxiety, Israeli military spokesperson Effie Defren said in a video statement. IDF troops have pulled back, he said, but still control much of the Gaza Strip. He urged people there to stay away from those areas. This afternoon, thousands of Palestinians were on the move, most of them on foot. The World's Matthew Bell has been following the story. He's with me now in the studio. Hi, Matthew.
Hello.
So those scenes that we're seeing with these huge crowds of people in Gaza walking along the coastal road, they're pretty dramatic. Is this a sign that the ceasefire is actually beginning to take hold?
I think it is. There were reports this morning, first thing, in different parts of the Gaza Strip of artillery strikes, continued military activity. But the IDF said the ceasefire began around midday, and that's when things seemed to go quiet. It didn't take long for Palestinians to start moving in various parts of the territory. These videos showed thousands of people, mostly walking some vehicles, but walking up the coastal road toward Gaza City. This is where the Israeli military focused its offensive in recent weeks, and it appears that they started pulling out of Gaza City last night. Remember, Gaza City was the biggest urban center in the Gaza Strip before the war. About 700,000 people live there. And like much of the territory, a lot of the buildings there are damaged or destroyed, and that is what a lot of people are returning to right now.
Returning to see what is left. As that IDF spokesperson said, as part of the ceasefire deal, Israeli troops have pulled back. Where are they exactly now?
So there's a map that was put up by the White House that illustrates this really well, and it shows a yellow line that was agreed to through negotiations with Hamas. The Israelis, where the IDF has now apparently pulled back to, it still leaves the Israeli military in direct control of about 50% of the Gaza Strip. And the IDF says that it can operate anywhere it wants to. But later phases of this peace plan will see Israeli troops pulling back further to a couple of other lines. Eventually, they will still have one security zone around the edge of the Gaza Strip.
But so a phased pullback.
Exactly, as the different steps go forward. What's supposed to happen now and what the Israeli public will be watching for very closely is the release of the remaining hostages. This is 20 people that are thought to be still alive and another 28 bodies of people taken on October 7th. This exchange is supposed to happen on Monday or Tuesday.
All eyes on that next week then, of course. And what is the status of aid deliveries into Gaza, this hugely important issue? Have those started going in?
Humanitarian aid groups say they're ready to start sending in the trucks. They have food, medicine, other supplies. in the area ready to go. A UN official told the Associated Press today that Israel, which controls the border crossings into Gaza, has given the United Nations permission to start delivering this aid. This is also part of the peace plan that Donald Trump brokered. News reports say that 600 humanitarian aid trucks will be going into Gaza every day from here on out. Remember that much of the Palestinian population is in desperate need of assistance. This is more than 2 million people, most of which have been driven from their homes. People have been struggling to get the basics every day, food, water, medicine. As recently as August, the UN determined that hundreds of thousands of Palestinians were facing starvation circumstances.
Another step in this peace plan is the release of Palestinian prisoners from Israeli jails. What do we know about this?
This could also begin as soon as Monday, and it would coincide with the release of Israeli hostages from Gaza. In all, Israel has agreed to free around 2,000 Palestinian prisoners. This is one group of 250 who are serving life sentences. Some of them have been behind bars for decades. And seeing these people go free for a lot of Israelis is going to be a bitter pill because they consider that these Palestinians have blood on their hands. There's another group, more than 1,700 other detainees will be released. They were apparently detained in Gaza over the last 2 years. A top Hamas official last night said that all women and children being held in Israeli jails are going to be freed. But probably the best-known Palestinian prisoner, Marwan Barghouti is his name. He's serving multiple life sentences for his role in the Second Intifada. He will not be released in this deal, and that's according to an Israeli official. But it seems like some of this, including the specific prisoners involved, is probably going to be subject of ongoing negotiations. And it's worth mentioning, I think, that a lot of specifics, when you look at this 20-point plan, still need to be negotiated if this thing continues to move ahead.
The World's Matthew Bell, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Another unresolved part of the Trump peace plan for Gaza is about Hamas giving up its weapons. In the past, the group has said this is a red line it is not willing to cross. Today, after 2 years of fighting and with most of the Hamas leadership killed, the group's tone seems to have shifted. The World's Shirin Jafari reports.
Earlier this year, the Trump administration reached out to a man called Bishara Bahba to facilitate talks with Hamas. Bahba, a Palestinian-American academic, said yes.
Well, I mean, it's a, I guess, once-in-a-lifetime experience.
Bahba was born in East Jerusalem to parents who fled the first Arab-Israeli war. In the 1970s, his parents settled in the U.S. and he went to Harvard University. Bahba has been involved in past negotiations between the Palestinians and the Israelis. This time, he became sort of a messenger between the Trump administration and Hamas's political leaders.
The objective has all along been for me to see an end to this war and tragedy.
He's lost family members, he says, and this work is personal. Bahba's last meeting with Hamas leaders was last week, he says, just as they were getting ready to go to Egypt to finalize the peace deal.
I told them that they need to keep an open mind, to be flexible.
There are still major issues in the 20-point plan that need to be worked out. Disarming Hamas is one of the biggest sticking points. Bahba tells me from his conversations with the group, they seem mostly open to the idea.
U.S. officials have said that disarmament, from their perspective, could entail the handing over of heavy military equipment while allowing them to retain personal firearms. If that's the case, I think that they are committed to disarm in that fashion.
In this case, heavy military equipment means things like rockets. Yossi Kopperwasser heads the Jerusalem Institute for Strategy and Security. He's formerly with the Israeli military intelligence. He says Hamas has suffered major blows, but Israel cannot underestimate its capabilities.
It's amazing that after 2 years, they still don't seem to be suffering from a shortage of equipment.
Kopperwasser says as the Israeli military entered Gaza City recently, it found caches of weapon. He says Israel must condition the reconstruction of Gaza to Hamas giving up its arms. Because in the past, when Israel hasn't done that, it's only led to future wars and emboldening of the group.
We have to make sure that the Palestinians know that their sacrifice was not justified. And the way to do it is to make sure that Hamas leaves power and is removed from power in Gaza. That's the way to deliver the message that 7th of October was a terrible mistake.
Tahani Mustafa, with the European Council on Foreign Relations, says past experience has shown Palestinians that disarming can leave them open to violence from Israeli forces. Like in the early 2000s, she says, when Fatah, the Palestinian faction leading the occupied West Bank, handed over most of its weapons in exchange for a promised state. That never came to fruition.
And what was worse was that Israel at that time had very much abused what it reserved for itself, the right to go into Palestinian communities, conduct targeted assassinations, mass arrests, incursions that often, you know, always come with Palestinian fatalities and destruction of civic infrastructure.
Some of that continues in the West Bank today, Mustafa adds. She says Hamas wants to keep its smaller personal arms, not just because of threats from the Israeli army and some settlers.
I mean, Hamas is not by any measure popular within the occupied territories, neither before the 7th and certainly not after the 7th. So there is a lot of concern that this could leave many members, if they do disarm, vulnerable to potential sort of intercommunal retribution and seeking justice.
For disarmament to be effective and durable, it needs to be part of a broader political process. That's according to Oliver McTernan, who directs a UK-based NGO called Forward Thinking.
In international law, Gaza is an occupied territory. Until there is an establishment of a Palestinian state with real agency and sovereignty, I think we will always have the real risk and threat of violence in the region.
McTernan has spent more than two decades working in conflict resolution. He says peace negotiations and disarmament can take years to come through, as it did in Northern Ireland. The Trump administration announced last night that it will be sending around 200 troops to the Middle East to oversee the implementation of the deal. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
Only about 100,000 people around the globe speak the ancient language of Ladino. One musician wants to save the language one song at a time. Ladino singer Nani Vazana has been touring the U.S., Europe, and Israel this year. We spoke to her back in March before she left to go on tour. From Vazana's home in the Netherlands, she told us more about the language, her music, and her quest to save Ladino.
Ladino is an ancient language from the Middle Ages. Originally from Spain and Portugal. It's a Jewish language, and it was created by the women of the community. It's a matriarchal language. One of my first memories is singing or hearing my grandmother singing in Ladino, and I always wanted to do something in Ladino so I could dedicate it to her. And Una Secunda Piel is the first song I ever wrote in Ladino, both the lyrics and the text. Because Ladino is spoken all over the world today, I feel that it has to represent a lot of different cultures and kind of naturally flows that way. By doing that, I hope to create something that can help evolve Ladino a little bit, not only to keep it alive, but also create a new, maybe millennial, maybe Gen Z community around the language so they can help revive it as well. Another song that I'd like to play for you today is Sin Dinguni Chovaron, which means without any sons. It's an ancient text, a poem that I found while researching for the new record from the 13th century. It's about a family with seven daughters, and the father is very upset that the mother did not bear him any sons. And then one of the daughters steps up and says, "Well, I will be the son you never had because I have the making of a man, and actually I would like you to use male pronouns with me from now on." When I saw this text, I had chills down my spine. I thought, like, this is the perfect song for the record, especially in the point of view of what we are dealing with today, which are questions that have been asked 700 and 1,000 years ago. And so I took this poem and I composed the music, and there it is. No mos maligas, mi
padre. No mos maligas, mi señor. Ladino singer Nani Vazana speaking to us from her home in Amsterdam. This is her song, Sin Din Gun Hovaron. You're with the world. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Most of us spend our days surrounded by electronics, phones in our pockets, computers in front of us, clocks on the wall. They all require rare earth minerals, and almost all of those are refined in China. The Chinese government has just announced new restrictions that will limit the export of some of those minerals.
They're also used in a wide variety of automobiles, especially EVs and hybrids. And then significantly for the United States, these elements are important also for a wide array of defense systems.
That's John Zinn. He's a fellow at the Brookings Institution focusing on China. He told me today that the restrictions deal with the entire supply chain, not just the raw material at the point of export.
So if it's going to be used in a defense application, then it's going to be a no-go, is what they've said under these new rules. If it's going to be for civilian use, then it's a possibility that the license would be approved, right? But that's part of what's novel here, is that there's licensing not just for the minerals themselves, but for other elements of the supply chain as well.
So this may or may not impact like our cell phones or our computers going forward.
It could very well. And I think that is where China has left itself some wiggle room. And this is the real question whenever they impose these export controls, is how stringently are they going to implement and enforce them? How difficult is it going to be to get one of these licenses? Mm-hmm. I think they've recognized this year that they have a real chokehold on this. I think they were a little surprised by how effective this was in gaining leverage over the United States earlier this year.
And these are different from earlier export restrictions on rare earth minerals because they cover more of the minerals and also more restrictions on who they can end up in the hands of?
Who they can end up with, and then also how they get processed and refined, and how you actually take the mineral from something in the ground to actually making it a magnet or some other kind of piece of equipment that goes into it, right? Because China doesn't just control a lot of the processing for that. They also control a lot of the intellectual property that goes into those processes. Mm-hmm. So the intellectual property itself for turning it from a piece of rock in the ground to an actual widget that goes into a defense system or into your phone, that is all now subject to these export controls as well. So that's really the key difference.
And they are the only ones with the knowledge of how to transform these raw materials into a usable material for like a cell phone. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, and it's not just that they're the only ones with the knowledge. There are others, and there have been efforts from under the Trump administration to try to build out supply chains that don't depend on China, but they have a massive advantage in this, right? Both in the extraction of it, but also in the processing. They have put a lot of time and energy and manpower into perfecting these processes in recent decades. And so they just have an outsized role in this. So there have been discussions underway in Washington for quite some time about how to develop alternative supply chains and diversify our supply chain so we're not so heavily dependent on China. But that is going to take a lot of money and, more importantly, a lot of time to get that right.
And so why is China adding these minerals to this list of export controls now?
The timing question is a really interesting one, right? Because the U.S. has imposed similar kind of export controls on semiconductor technology in particular under our foreign direct product rule back during the Biden administration, right? So this is not necessarily a one-for-one response. If anything, the vibe was pretty happy just as of a couple of weeks ago, relatively, in the bilateral relationship between the U.S. and China, because both sides were preparing for a potential summit on the margins of the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Liberation Summit at the end of the month between President Trump and President Xi. So the timing here is really interesting because this seems it's not in response to something proximate. I think they did it intentionally right before that meeting. Right. I think they feel like they have leverage over the United States going into that meeting. They feel that President Trump wanted the meeting and wanted some kind of deal. And that gave them room to pursue these measures and press the United States.
So this is potentially something that China can negotiate on as it continues these trade talks in this tit for tat tariff war.
Yeah, exactly. Potentially. And I think what's really important, one of the details in the announcement from the Chinese side is that these will not go into effect until December 1st. So that provides some runway for a conversation to happen about what are going to be the parameters of this export control, how stringently are they going to be implemented, and other aspects of this as well, because there are a lot of questions floating around.
Could these just be scrapped entirely, depending on the outcome of trade talks?
I think that's unlikely. What happened in the earlier phases of the trade war after the Trump administration imposed its quote-unquote Liberation Day tariffs back in April is that China agreed to resume exports of rare earths to the United States, but left the new export control regime that it had put in place, it left that intact, right? So U.S. companies still had to go through the process of getting a license. It was, again, that core question of how hard was it going to be to get that license and how hard was it going to be to access those minerals. And that is my understanding of what was agreed to.
So Chinese officials have cited national security as the reason for these restrictions. What are the facts that back that up?
I think, you know, from their perspective, I think the most important aspect of this that backs it up is, you know, some of these minerals and products do go into U.S. defense systems. And I think that's probably going to be the part that will be the least negotiable with the Chinese because of that element of the equation. Right. But for other things, I think there's less of a national security case to be made for it, probably where there's more room for negotiation as well.
What questions do you have looking ahead at how this plays out?
Well, I think the crucial question is whether or not some kind of meeting actually happens now between President Trump and President Xi. And this is fast moving, but the president just went on social media this morning saying he sees no reason now to meet with Xi at APEC. And
because of this new rule.
Because of this move, right? And he says very explicitly in his post that he was surprised by this. And that the U.S. is considering its own suite of countermeasures. It could be financial, he said. It could be a tariff escalation, right? So this was very much a high-risk move by the Chinese side that could have blown up this meeting, and it seems like they were willing to take that risk. So I think that's going to be really key about how this all plays out, whether a meeting goes back on the books or whether we are in for another period of escalation like what we saw back in the spring.
The back and forth continues.
Yeah, and I think what China learned from that last round of escalation and de-escalation is that I think they felt they had, if not more leverage over the United States, they were willing to endure more pain than the United States was. Right? I think the perspective from Beijing was very much that the Trump administration blinked and walked back on the tariffs, and Beijing got a return to the status quo ante that existed, which I think they were very comfortable with. And I think that has fed the timing of all this, right? I don't think they would make this kind of move unless they thought that they would come out ahead on the other end of this.
Interesting.
And maybe they've miscalculated, but that's a real possibility. But I think that was their calculation going into this.
That was John Zinn speaking with me from the Brookings Institution earlier today. People in Venezuela hear the voice of their opposition leader in hiding when a recording of a phone call goes viral. It's a phone call to tell her she's just won the Nobel Peace Prize. Also ahead on the show, France's government keeps dissolving, and that is a problem for France, but it is also a problem for the rest of Europe. Stay tuned. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. The suspense is now over. We have a winner.
The Norwegian Nobel Committee has decided to award the Nobel Peace Prize for 2025 to Maria Corina Machado.
Maria Corina Machado, the Venezuelan politician who led a movement to oppose the country's authoritarian leader, Nicolas Maduro, in the 2024 presidential election. Although he declared victory, she is widely believed to have won more votes. Machado has been in hiding for the last year. In today's announcement, the Nobel Committee called her a brave and committed champion of peace who keeps the flame of democracy burning amidst a growing darkness. The World's To Be Saizea reports on the significance of this award for Venezuelans.
It was just before 5 in the morning when the phone rang somewhere in Venezuela.
Hello?
Hello.
Yes?
Yes. Hello? Am I talking to Maria Corina Machado?
The voice on the line came from Oslo. Still half asleep, Maria Corina Machado listened as the secretary of the Norwegian Nobel Committee told her she had just won the Nobel Peace Prize.
Well, I have no words. Thank you so much, but I hope you understand this is a movement. This is an achievement of a whole society. I am just one person.
Her stunned reaction quickly went viral across Venezuela, where she's known as the Iron Lady. For more than 2 decades, Machado has challenged Venezuela's socialist regime, which has ruled for 27 years under Hugo Chavez and Nicolás Maduro. She built a powerful social movement that managed to unite a fractured opposition ahead of the 2024 presidential election.
La nuestra es una lucha cívica y pacífica.
Her rallies, often held in small towns across the country, drew massive crowds of Venezuelans desperate for change. Her movement is widely believed to have defeated Maduro in a vote the government refused to recognize. And after that, Machado went into hiding. Her allies were exiled or jailed, and her movement was forced underground. Political analyst Vanessa Neumann, a personal friend of hers, says Machado's courage comes at a high personal cost.
Maria Corina Machado has basically stayed in country really alone while everybody else has fled. She has given up her children, her marriage, and stayed in country to carry on the fight. She's always been very clear-eyed and very brave.
Human rights groups say hundreds of political prisoners remain behind bars in Venezuela, many tortured. On the streets of Caracas, the news of Machado's novel spread fast. My colleague Isabel Guerrero spoke with people in the streets about what it means. It's a pride for all of us, says Luis Blanco, a plumber. It sends a message to the world, says Eddie Peña, because it shows that Venezuelans have not been forgotten, she says. Under Maduro's rule, roughly a third of Venezuela's population has fled the country, escaping economic collapse and repression. Among them, Michelle Núñez, who shared this voice note from Germany.
I was actually in a supermarket here in Germany, and I wanted everybody to notice how important this news was for me, for every Venezuelan. I wanted them to know that I was Venezuelan.
For her supporters, Machado represents endurance and hope. David Smildy, who researches Venezuela at Tulane University, says the Nobel Committee's decision is as strategic as it is symbolic.
Oftentimes, the Nobel Committee seems to use these awards not to celebrate the past, but to sort of affect the future course of events, by getting awardees to sort of live up to their new international status.
Smildy says the prize could unify Venezuela's opposition, at least temporarily, but real change will be slow. Many Venezuelans are skeptical that anything can topple the regime. But when the world spoke to Maria Corina Machado 2 years ago, she said she was determined to bring democracy back to Venezuela.
This is not seen as a political struggle, but as an existential one, even a spiritual one. So I think Venezuela is prepared and determined to have political change, and the world should be prepared to see Maduro being defeated.
In recent weeks, the Trump administration has intensified its stance toward Venezuela, combining aggressive language with controversial military operations in the Caribbean. Still, many analysts say it's uncertain whether that pressure can actually force Maduro from power. For millions of Venezuelans, Maria Corina Machado's Nobel Peace Prize, it's a glimmer of recognition and perhaps a fragile sign of hope. For the world, I'm Tibisa Isea.
Australia has signed two major security deals this week, first with Papua New Guinea earlier in the week, and yesterday another deal with India. That's left one country unhappy, China. Earlier today, I spoke with Patricia O'Brien. She's an Australia and Pacific analyst at Georgetown University in Washington.
These agreements change the game in the Pacific in terms of the geostrategic landscape in the Pacific, and they have very far-reaching implications.
Why is this limiting options for China? Why would this be seen as hostile?
China has been active and very ambitious in what they want to achieve with Papua New Guinea for many years. And this agreement puts a lot of complications for China into the mix.
So tell me more about what exactly is in these agreements.
Well, for the Papua New Guinea one, it's a mutual defense agreement.
So if a country were to attack either, then both countries would respond?
Correct. And Australia has a mutual defense agreement with the United States and New Zealand. That agreement was signed in 1951. So this is a very significant development in terms of that history.
So it's the first security agreement like this that Australia has entered in since 1951.
Yes, the defense obligations, and then there's also a significant component about integrating the defense forces of Australia and Papua New Guinea. So Papua New Guineans can get recruited into the Australian defense force and vice versa. Also, part of the agreement allows Australian defence mobilisation and access across Papua New Guinea, so sort of like unlimited access across Papua New Guinea. That is the piece of the puzzle which is particularly frustrating for China, because it's a huge move to deny them access to port facilities and runways and all those kind of things within Papua New Guinea, which is an incredibly strategic part of the Indo-Pacific.
And those are some of the things that China had been angling for years that you mentioned earlier?
Well, they've been making moves right across the Pacific to try to increase their ability to get port access and other military access, most significantly with their security agreement with the Solomon Islands, which is New Guinea's neighbour. But that security agreement with the Solomon Islands is a very important context for why Australia is signing this agreement.
So back to kind of how this impacts the Australia-China relationship. Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese visited Beijing this summer. That was seen as an attempt to ease tensions with China. Where does that relationship stand today with this kind of alliance race happening in the Pacific between Australia and China?
What people will say publicly is that the temperature has been lowered because Albanese made this big overture in the middle of the year. But the actions of Australia say otherwise, because of the deal with India, the deal with Papua New Guinea. They are attempting to do a deal with Vanuatu, although that one is not really progressing the way Australia wants it to go. There's been some very strong language coming out of Vanuatu in recent days that don't look positive for Australia sealing that deal.
You mentioned Vanuatu. Where else is Australia looking to for new security partners?
I mean, I think Australia is trying, from what I understand, to get agreements throughout the Pacific. And it has already secured agreements with Tuvalu and Nauru in December 2024. But that followed Nauru switching its allegiance from Taiwan to China earlier in the year. So Australia is trying to balance out what Nauru did.
And Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese will be visiting the US and visiting President Trump next week, correct?
That's right. So Australia has been very keen to have this meeting. And the main reason for that is securing the AUKUS agreement. There's been some doubt about whether the new administration is 100% behind the AUKUS agreement.
AUKUS is an Australia-US agreement?
Yes. There's been this real doubt about whether Trump is going to be behind the AUKUS agreement, but its indications are now positive, I think, for that. But that is certainly something that will be talked about.
Patricia O'Brien is an Australia and Pacific analyst at Georgetown University. Staying in the Pacific for just a moment, two massive offshore earthquakes shook the Philippines this morning, killing at least seven people. The first was a 7.4 magnitude earthquake, and the subsequent quake was a 6.8. Authorities issued tsunami warnings, but that threat has passed and the warnings have been lifted. Philippine President Bongbong Marcos has said that search and rescue teams are being assembled. Today's earthquakes are among the biggest to hit the Philippines in recent years. Over the summer, several European lawmakers agreed to undergo testing for traces of PFAS, also known as forever chemicals, in their bloodstreams. PFAS has been linked to a whole host of health problems, from cancer and liver damage to decreased fertility. These chemicals are in products that people use all the time. The results of those blood tests came back this week, and as the World's Europe correspondent Orla Berry reports, they tell a much bigger story.
It was Magnus Heunicke, Denmark's environment minister, who came up with the notion to subject two dozen of his EU colleagues to blood tests.
It was my idea because we were discussing how to put these chemicals on the agenda and we needed some new ways of discussing it.
Heunicke says he already knew that the chemicals PFAS were everywhere and the test results proved him right. Everyone tested positive. Some results, though, did take Heunicke by surprise.
What is shocking is that many of them that we found in our blood is forbidden and has been forbidden for years.
PFAS are a group of about 10,000 man-made chemicals. They're famously resistant to water, grease and high temperatures, which is why they end up in your non-stick frying pans and raincoats. But that resistance means the chemicals don't break down easily either. Heunicke's own test results were troubling.
The ones they found, they are linked to a series of very, very serious diseases. And, you know, PFOA, we know, could cause organ damages in the liver, causing cancer, actually. And I think I would rather not have them in my blood, in my body, but it is there.
In 2023, Denmark and four other EU countries proposed a near-total ban on PFAS across the bloc. That proposal, which is still under review by the EU Commission, has run into fierce resistance. Lobbyists from the semiconductor, pharmaceutical, military and other manufacturing sectors argue that there are no viable alternatives to PFAS, that a ban would destroy Europe's industrial competitiveness and lead to millions of job losses. Heunicke says he has faith in the EU Commission that it won't cave to industry pressure, but Cecil Dukia with ChemSec, an environmental NGO, isn't so sure.
I'm a little bit in doubt. I mean, the Commission was committed earlier to ban all uses of PFAS unless they were critical to society, but it's very unsure what will actually happen.
In August, the European Chemicals Agency, an EU body, announced it would temporarily exempt eight sectors from a PFAS ban, including medical and military industries. ChemSec and other NGOs have called the move a disaster. For some, though, an EU-wide ban may already be too late.
I mean, for us and my family, it doesn't matter of those products in the home because we are so polluted the rest of our lives. So it doesn't even matter.
Herman Afzelius lives in Kallinge, a small town in Ronneby municipality in Sweden. In 2013, residents heard in the news that the local water supply had been switched to a new source. Their tap water had been found to contain high levels of PFAS. The local council said there was nothing to worry about. But 6 months later, all of Kalinga's residents received letters asking them to go for a blood test.
That was the really point when I really reacted. Okay, why do I need to leave my blood and my children and so on? That's the point when I realized, damn, this has been going on probably for a very long time.
Afzelius's blood was tested for PFAS chemicals.
It was shockingly high. I mean, it was maybe 50 times higher than what's kind of normal, you know, the background levels. It was really, really high, and also my kids.
His daughter Nala, who was 4 at the time, had PFAS levels 30 times higher than the norm, he says. The town of Kalinga is home to a military base, and for years firefighters would go there to train, spraying foam that would later seep into the soil. The foam has since proven to contain very high levels of PFAS. Earlier this month, the EU announced a ban on the use of PFAS in firefighting foams. Afzelius says he expected the local council to take responsibility for what happened, but it did nothing, he says.
Yeah, I mean, it's horrible. I don't know the English word I'm looking for. It's like a betrayal. It's really hard to explain, but it's, you really feel that they left us behind totally.
Eventually, Afzelius and dozens of other residents came together and sued the municipality. 7 years later, Sweden's Supreme Court ruled in the residents' favour. That legal challenge, though, wasn't his only battle. In 2021, Afzelius was diagnosed with a rare form of cancer. And he's not alone. The group that took the council to court had appointed 6 board members.
4 of 6 have got cancer last 5 years.
That's 4 out of the 6, he says, and they're all under 50. Afzelius says he's happy to see EU lawmakers waking up to the dangers of forever chemicals, even if for him it seems to be years too late. He will keep speaking out, he says, because maybe something can be done to protect future generations. For the World, I'm Orla Barry.
You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. France just got a new prime minister, the same one who resigned earlier this week after just weeks in office. French President Emmanuel Macron reappointed Sébastien Lecornu after heated negotiations with party leaders across the political spectrum. France has gone through 6 prime ministers in 2 years, plunging the country and Macron especially into political chaos. All this turmoil also has French allies across the globe on edge. The World's Jerry Haddon reports from the French city of Montpellier.
More than 3 out of 4 French voters want President Macron gone from power. That's according to a national poll this week. In the 8 years since the centrist, business-friendly leader came to office, a lot of people say life has only gotten harder.
On débourse beaucoup d'argent, et nous, en termes de pouvoir d'achat, en tant que citoyens, c'est toujours compliqué, quoi.
Take Dylan, a young man working in a smartphone repair shop in downtown Montpellier. He tells me salaries are not keeping up with rising prices, for food, for rent, for everything, he says. Dylan says he doesn't blame Macron for that, but he does say the president made things worse by trying to raise taxes, pushing back the retirement age, and cutting social services. A lot of people agree with Dylan, as in millions of people. This is from one of several nationwide protests this fall against Macron's cost-cutting measures. Those measures are meant to reduce France's ballooning debt, but each time Macron goes taxing and slashing, his shaky coalition collapses. All this instability, political and financial, is bad for France, but it's also worrying for the 27-member European Union.
The big one, and the most pressing, is the possibility of another Greek-style sovereign debt crisis.
So says Joseph Downing, a senior lecturer and expert on France at Aston University in Birmingham.
Because they're part of the Eurozone, this could also drag the rest of the EU into some sort of debt crisis if France can't get a grip on spending, can't get a grip on political instability, requires some sort of IMF external type bailout, it would be catastrophic for the Eurozone, precisely because France is the Eurozone's kind of second largest economy after Germany.
At a time when Germany's economy is faltering as well. Finances aside, Downing says the crisis also threatens gains Macron has won for Europe on the world stage.
in that Macron has been very much focused on reasserting France's role both internationally but also specifically within the context of the European Union. So pushing for greater EU integration, pushing for the creation of a European army.
And for an EU that can defend itself and its allies on its own. Last March, after a summit with President Trump and Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, Macron emerged from the White House sounding like a statesman. He said Europe was Ukraine's security guarantee, independent of the U.S.
Et ce que je veux faire depuis maintenant plusieurs années, c'est remettre l'Europe autour de la table.
For years now, I have wanted to get Europe back at the head of the table, he told French reporters. Europe, throughout the Cold War, he said, never built its own security architecture. If we Europeans can't stop Russia's military aggression, he said, our own security is at risk. Only a strong, united Europe, he said, guarantees peace on the continent. Ironically, that foreign policy vision resonates domestically, even among Macron's many detractors.
Sur le côté national, non, mais sur le côté international, heureusement qu'on a un Macron. Voilà.
One local resident in Montpellier, who will only give her first name Dominique, says Macron has failed at home, but internationally, she says, we're lucky to have him. Look at Ukraine, she says, he stood up for Ukraine. And he stood up to President Donald Trump, says Sébastien Maillard, a European analyst at the think tank Chatham House in the UK. For example, the two leaders diverged on climate change. That display of independent thinking combined with power has actually helped bolster the bilateral relationship, Maillard says.
The fact that he represents a G7 country, the fact that France has a nuclear deterrence and quite an important army, but also the fact that Macron speaks good English and is able to get into a personal relationship, I think that helped make him respected.
Well, thank you very much, everybody. It's a great honor to be with a friend of mine, Emmanuel Macron, President of France.
This was President Trump just 2 weeks ago with Macron back at the White House discussing the wars in Ukraine and in Gaza.
He's doing a really good job. He's fighting hard. He's fighting on a lot of fronts.
Lots of praise there, but Maillard says ultimately President Trump warms most to strength. And if Macron continues to bleed prime ministers, he's weakened on the world stage. And domestically, that plays into the hands of France's far-right National Rally Party, or NR. In snap elections in 2024, the NR won the most votes, though not an outright majority, but its popularity remains high. Maillard and Aston University's Joseph Downing are quick to point out that France's far-right has never actually held power. They say it would likely become more centrist when faced with the realities of ruling. That's a European issue, but Downing says there's a larger global struggle underway between democracies and autocracies.
The kind of which we've not seen since the end of the Cold War, in a sense that democracies and democratic norms are under attack. Autocracies like Russia and China are doing a very good job of fighting that public relations war against democracies, right? In the sense that, you know, your public finances are terrible, there's no law and order, you know, immigration's out of control.
So, says Downing, it's in the interest of democracies everywhere for France to form a government, fix its finances, and maintain a united European front against Russia and other anti-democratic forces. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon, Montpellier, France.
Often we end the show on a Friday with some music, but today I am grabbing some sound I love from the archive to ease you into spooky season. Not the soundtrack from a haunted house, though it could be yours. This is the sound of space, or rather Venus's atmosphere. NASA has a satellite that dipped into the planet's upper atmosphere back in the summer of 2020. It recorded radio waves, and NASA then translated those radio waves into sound waves we all could hear. This research revealed how Venus's atmosphere reacts to the sun, giving scientists more insight into why Venus is so very different from Earth, despite their similar sizes. The probe, called the Parker Solar Probe, also flew super close to the sun through its corona in 2021. Here are some more spooky sounds from that mission. That's a young solar wind being born in the plasma around the sun. The wind blows at roughly 1 million miles an hour, and that thing that sounded like TV static, it is dust from asteroids colliding with the space probe at unbelievable speeds. This is all sound you can grab online, so please go ahead and make the nerdiest haunted house soundtrack ever this Halloween. Let me know if you do. It will be delightful to hear. The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. Find us online anytime at theworld.org and find our original reporting on YouTube. Be sure to subscribe to our new channel there. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Have a great weekend and join us when we're back here on Monday.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Jan Elizabeth, Jane Johnson, Kira and Peter McGrath, Leslie Meadowcroft, Maggie Walker, Ravi Mohan, and Rich Gorlick. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.